Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast, Friday edition. I guess we'll call it. I am your host, Gary Gramling. We are through the first round of the 2020 NFL Draft, the virtual draft. I am about to bring a special guest on to run through the big storylines from the night. I don't have any more to this intro, so I'll just bring him in right now. Andy Benoit is the special guest. Andy, you were churning hard on those draft grades tonight at the MMQB, which was very much appreciated. But how are you feeling after all this?
You know, honestly, I've had a thumb injury, and I forgot about it until about pick 25 when I realized typing all night long is a problem for the thumb. So I do not feel great. And it reminds, earlier this year, like in December, I had the slightest little cut on the top of my thumb, like just how skin will splint apart.
Yeah.
But it was right where I hit the clicker for pause, play, and all the buttons on the film remote. So I'm using that part of my thumb 10,000 times a day, like truly 10. I'm just hitting with it constantly. So I had a giant bandage on, almost like a makeshift cast, which made me look like the biggest weenie in the history of mankind. Because everybody knew it was nothing under there, but that was the only way I could keep my thumb from reopening that tiny little gash I'd hurt. So well, I feel pathetic tonight, like I did that time, because I'm hurt from typing.
These sound a lot like the injuries that like George Jetson used to get from pushing the buttons for space sprockets. Yep. But more than that, this is also, I mean, these are the problems you run into with the sort of unique draft season. I would have liked to have had the MMQB team doctors examine you before we hired you to do these things. And maybe we would have caught this and we wouldn't be in this problem right now.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I'm home alone and you know that's the way it goes.
All right. Well, let's get to it here. We're going to, we're not going to start with the biggest surprise of the night, because the biggest surprise of the night was the fact that the Seahawks did not trade out of the first round. But we'll start with the second biggest surprise of the night, and that is that the Packers come up and get Jordan Love. And I feel like this is one of those things where everyone's kind of looking, who's going to take Jordan Love? He's going to be the fourth quarterback. There's no fourth team that has an obvious need at quarterback. So who's it going to be? And, you know, you sort of throw in, well, Packers have an old guy, so maybe the Packers. And I feel like it was really half-hearted until we actually saw it happen tonight.
I was blown away. I was absolutely blown away by that. And I don't get blown away very often watching the NFL draft anymore. You just kind of get numb to things, or things just don't surprise you as much as they used to. This one really surprised me. And imagine if you're Aaron Rodgers and you've said publicly, you know, you didn't say it in these words, but you basically said they better not draft a quarterback. And you were one game from the Super Bowl. Now, you know, it's a big game. You got killed in the NFC Championship, but you're one game from the Super Bowl. You're still at your height as a QB. You might not quite be what you were physically, but you're still a top five quarterback. Certainly in your mind, you're a top two or three quarterback, I would think. And they draft your replacement instead of getting you help right away. Here's the story of the offseason. And it was these guys last year. It was Matt LaFleur and Rodgers, and everybody wondering how they're going to get along. And it went very well in the end, because both guys gave a little and they met in the middle, and it went great. And now this whole thing starts all over again. And I think it's a tough position for Green Bay for this year. Obviously, they're fine with it because they made the move. But I Rodgers does not seem like the guy that will take this easily.
I was going to say, it's a tough position for Green Bay. It's a tough position for Jordan Love, who is going to be sort of thrown in here. And look, this is a guy who had, his range of outcomes is enormously wide here. Already some, Deshaun Kizer Part 2 type of takes going on out here. Obviously some people will make the Mahomes comparisons as far as the absolute highlights that he puts out there. But I guess I have two questions here, Andy. Number one, realistically, do you think Rodgers can play at this level until he's 40? He's not MVP Rodgers, but he's still very good.
Correct. Yeah, he's very good. I wouldn't assume he can play until he's 40. That's a bit of a leap, I think. Now, we've seen more quarterbacks do that, of course, and Drew Brees has compensated very well for his physical decline, and it has not been a horrible physical decline. Rodgers is only 36 still. So whether you think he's playing till he's 40 or not, that's 4 years from now. And in the NFL, that's a lifetime. That's everybody who got drafted tonight, that's nearly the end of their contract. So they might, some of these guys might be on different teams at this point. So no, I don't know if that matters. If I'm Aaron Rodgers, I don't give a crap about any of that. I'm just thinking about the here and now, because I'm 36 and we're a Super Bowl type team.
And I'll play devil's advocate for a minute here. If you're the Packers, you're probably looking at yourself and saying, you know, we're not going to be drafting top 10. We're always going to be at the end of the first round. Perhaps they're looking at Jordan Love saying, like, wow, this guy, obviously the ceiling's very high. And you know, hey, this is a top half of the first round guy to us. This is a future franchise quarterback. We think he can get there. Essentially, his contract doesn't matter. He's going to be a bargain on his rookie contract as far as even a backup quarterback at this point. So basically, you have 4 years to figure out if you have found your next franchise quarterback. And in the meantime, he's just a backup, and he's an affordable backup. And if you have to throw him into action, I guess you sort of cross that bridge when you get there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And look, here's the other part of this too. Because I can see it from Green Bay's perspective. The issue with Jordan Love is he needs his mechanics cleaned up. And there's some of the erratic throws that you saw at Utah State, it stemmed from the inconsistency in mechanics. When he's on, he's great. He's an up-and-down passer in an intriguing way, certainly. His ups are very high. Field vision's an issue. That'll get cleaned up naturally in the NFL, you think. Mechanics usually don't get cleaned up once you get to the NFL, except in this case, this guy is not going to have to play right away. And usually the reason mechanics don't get cleaned up is you get thrown into the game and you go back to what you know. It's just an instinct in human and athletic nature. So they have time to work with Love on his mechanics. And Matt LaFleur, when I first met Matt LaFleur, that's what I knew him as. This is the mechanics. This guy is as into passing mechanics as anyone I've ever seen. He has a philosophy. I'm sure he's very confident in his ability to teach it. And if he sees a man as talented as Jordan Love, every coach is going to want to work with that talent because they believe they're the ones who can shape it. And LaFleur has every reason to believe that because that's really what his foundation is as a coach. He's a mechanics guy.
All right. Well, they have some time to sort this out, but I feel like the office politics of it is going to get very ugly. Not very ugly, but it's just going to be unfortunate for a couple of years. But I don't know.
That's a tough. And no, look, maybe it'll work out fine. There were people that thought the LaFleur Rodgers pairing just was not going to work at all stylistically, and obviously it has. So maybe this thing works out absolutely fine, and we're making a mountain out of a molehill. That's what we'd be doing.
That is what we would be doing. I don't know. The Packers organization, granted,
it's not a molehill.
A lot of different guys.
Yeah.
A lot of different guys.
Yeah.
But they've seen it in that city before. There's an air. All right. Well, let's go to the guy who was supposed to be the big story of the night. And we all sat here all draft week, and the rumors were the Dolphins didn't like Tua, and maybe the Chargers don't like Tua. And then where does Tua land? Do the Jaguars take Tua? Do the Raiders take Tua? Who's going to stop Tua's fall? And in a very anticlimactic way, we just got to the fifth and sixth picks, and the two quarterbacks went, and that was the end of it. But Miami does end up with Tua Tagovailoa. Obviously their quarterback of the future. I feel like he can be their quarterback of the present if he is deemed healthy enough, and you know, by all reports he is healthy. I'm not quite sure why you'd hold him back, and I think stylistically he does fit in a Chan Gailey offense.
I wouldn't disagree with that. He'll be the starting quarterback at some point. That's how these things always go. And Ryan Fitzpatrick's the classic benchable guy because as good as he can be, and I think he can be good at times, you know, and I bet he'd tell you this. He's going to throw a half a dozen absolutely boneheaded, head-scratching type interceptions, and those are the kind of plays that give you a quick hook when there's a young QB waiting in the wings and sitting there on the bench, and you're, you know, let's say they're 2-5 at some point, the stadium's half full. Those kind of things add up a little bit, so Tua is the quarterback of the Dolphins. It's just a matter of exactly when he gets in. But the discussion from here is, what does that mean? What do you run with him? I don't know a lot about him, as you know, Gary, because I don't study these guys until they get to the NFL. But from people I respect and what I know and what I've seen of him, he's going to be a system type of QB. The system's going to have to work for him because his individual tools, they don't necessarily jump off the film from an NFL standpoint.
Well, they take Tua. They had two other first round picks here. Austin Jackson, who was considered something of a project among the offensive tackles here, USC guy, very young guy. Also, you probably all saw in the draft, because I'm assuming anyone listening to this show watched the draft. But as you saw, he had a bone marrow transplant for his sister, sort of lost his offseason last year, and some folks around the league think that slowed him down. But very athletic left tackle prospect. And look, I guess that's the other question with when does Tua get on the field. You kind of say, when do we have a offensive line that can protect him properly?
Yeah, you would say that. Now, this Gailey system will take care of that a little bit, we're guessing, because Gailey was very big on getting the ball out quickly at times mm-hmm. when we saw him last. It's been a long time since we've seen Chan Gailey, so maybe we don't know for sure. But, all of Miami's picks, really, Gary, had that kind of – they were in that vein of long-term projects because – like you said, Tua might not play immediately, and Austin Jackson, and then even the cornerback that they take, Igbinogani.
I might have gotten that wrong. You know what, Andy? When we do these shows, the one thing I hate that I do, it's the one thing I feel ashamed about when we finish a show is when I mispronounce guys' names, which I do too often, and I think it's rude and disrespectful, but...
You get some slack on this one. I bet he probably mispronounces it at times.
We might just be done talking about the Dolphins on the show.
Yeah, this is a hard look. We can adjust. Troy Polamalu, when he came along, that was probably a name that we thought that was going to be hard to learn, and it rolls off the tongue. If he plays, his name won't be an issue. But when I brought him up, my point is, from what I've seen and understood about him, he's kind of a developmental cornerback as well. Mm-hmm. He's only been in that position a couple years. So, yep. Really, you could look at all three of Miami's first-round selections tonight and say these were picks more with 2021 in mind than 2020, and I think that'd be totally acceptable. This team has fully committed to a very large-scale rebuilding effort, and last year's probably Chapter 1, and they did a great job with it. They won some games while implementing Chapter 1. This year's Chapter 2, and it's about a 10-chapter project.
Yeah, and on top of that, look, teams are going to lose work this summer, and we don't know how soon any of these rookies are going to be able to get on the field. The other quarterback, before we get to some of the other picks here, Justin Herbert. I shouldn't say that. We're going to talk about Joe Burrow toward the end of the show, but we've known Burrow was going to Cincinnati for quite a while now. But mm-hmm. The other quarterback up in the air coming into tonight, that was Justin Herbert. Goes to the Chargers, and look, I still think they have to sign Cam Newton. I think it makes even more sense now that you have Justin Herbert, who stylistically has enough similarities to Cam Newton that you could basically build a system with both of them in mind. But Herbert to the Chargers, we'll see. We'll see what he is. He's probably going to be he wasn't a quick strike guy at Oregon. I think downfield is where his strength is, and we'll see what the Chargers are going to run out there this year, because they signed a bunch of 30-something free agents, and it seems like they are ready to win now.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it, that they signed those ready to win now free agents, and then they draft a quarterback. So we'll see who they put out there, like you just said. Now, they do have the kind of players that you can get downfield with. I think Hunter Henry, obviously he's not a burner, but he gives you the seam element at the tight end. That's an important part of stretching the field, not because he gets over the top, but because you want to influence the middle field defenders so your outside receivers can be the ones that threaten over the top. And Keenan Allen and Mike Williams, neither guy is very fast. They're not slow, but they're certainly not fast. But there's a vertical nature to the way they play. They play jump ball football. It's above their head. They win one-on-one, 50-50 balls. So I think the kind of offense you need to run with Herbert, which is similar, as you said, to what you'd run with Cam Newton or a Josh Allen, He's got to have a sound running game, and they need some work on that. They need to add a back, and they need to probably add a lineman or two, at least for depth, if nothing else. But you need a sound running game, and then you need a play-action game built off of that, and those play-action games are going to be 15 to 25-yard type of throws, and that's what Herbert's going to have to do in the NFL.
The Chargers, as long as we're talking about them, they also jumped back up into the first round, got the Patriots pick. They end up taking Kenneth Murray, the Oklahoma linebacker, and this didn't hit me until after we had done our mock draft series part three, I think Kenneth Murray was in, and it hit me afterwards. But Kenneth Murray is Jared Davis, the Lions guy. He's one of those guys where you look at him and you say, well, you know, he's an athlete. He has all the physical traits to be a quality cover linebacker, but I just don't know if he ever will. I think he's just going to be a guy who on passing downs is always going to be a blitzer, is always going to be a pass rusher.
Well, and it's interesting that's how you put it, because Jared Davis this year became a blitzer and a pass rusher in that scheme for Detroit. I thought he looked great doing that.
Yeah.
So that might be a nice comp there. I know Greg Cosell, who we both respect very well, he saw Kenneth Murray kind of as a Rashawn Evans type. And Rashawn Evans coming out of Alabama and then what he's been with the Titans has been almost a pass rushing linebacker. And because anymore, you look at these guys first with the sub package in mind. What do they be? What can they be on nickel and dime situations? Evans is a pass rusher in Tennessee scheme. He lines up on the line of scrimmage a lot of the time. He blitzes, he drops. But, Murray, that's kind of the comp with him, at least for Greg or for Cosell. The Chargers don't play that kind of defense, though. The Chargers are the most straightforward execution-based defense in the NFL. They line up in the coverage that they're playing. They'll disguise a little because everybody disguises a little, but it's not a lot of disguise. And they play zone coverage and they try to get there with their four-man rush. If that's what they're going to be, and that's what Gus Bradley, their coordinator, has pretty much always been, then Murray, you're not getting the most out of his tools theoretically. So maybe they'll add some stuff because you have Murray and you have Derwin James. Those are two potentially unique attacking pieces you have there.
Yeah, when they came up and when they came up above the Saints, I figured they were going linebacker, but I would have liked Patrick Queen there. I think the Ravens got the perfect guy in Patrick Queen. Kind of shocked that just the Ravens always get all the things that they need.
We'll see. Yeah, Queen will be interesting because my sense is he might need to develop a little bit more physicality to really fit in with Baltimore. And then it raises the question, can that be instilled in a guy once he gets to the NFL? And I bet it can. I would imagine it could. And certainly there's a cultural element to it as well. I mean, you're with the Ravens. You've got a lot of veterans there. A coaching staff's been in place a while. So he has a good chance to develop, though. Any linebacker that has coverage skills, which is Queen's strength, that's what you would draft him first and foremost for, or at least what he can contribute in the passing down. Those guys have a chance in the NFL. That's what the position is. That's what's demanded of that position in today's game.
All right, let's talk about a couple of the positions that they weren't runs, but lots of guys went, and lots of interesting guys, and lots of consequences to some of these guys going. So let's start with the wide receivers. First guy off the board ends up being the speedster Henry Ruggs III. Goes to the Las Vegas Raiders. We talked about this a little bit on the mock draft show. We figured the Raiders were going to take a receiver. A lot of people connected them to CeeDee Lamb, who would seem to be a stylistic fit with Derek Carr. Henry Ruggs, not quite as much a stylistic fit. It's nice to have the complement to Tyrell Williams and what they have on the rest of the offense. But Ruggs, you can do the manufactured touch. You can do the get the ball in his hands quick and let him create type of stuff. But first and foremost, he's a downfield threat. And I know a lot of people will tweet at me and say Derek Carr has very good numbers when he throws downfield. He does not throw downfield very frequently. That is the problem. So
yep, that's fair. Yeah. Now, and when they're not doing it, there's a reason for it. There's a reason that you don't see it on the film. Now, we're not saying Carr can't do it. Certainly he can do it, but it's in his nature. He's not an innately aggressive passer. And I think John Gruden, my guess, and I do not know this at all. I don't even know. I've never met John Gruden. at least not as a coach. I met him in the Monday Night booth one time, I guess. Neither of us would really remember it. But as a coach, John Gruden, I bet, is always writing Carr about take a chance, be aggressive, fit it in there, because Carr is going to have to be prodded to do that a little bit. Now, Ruggs, in and of himself, you know, he's, I don't know if he's a contested catch guy or not, but obviously if you're drafting him early on, he doesn't have to be a contested catch guy. He runs away from people. Ruggs' value is going vertical and going downfield. So if you don't have a quarterback that's consistently willing to do that, then you have some questions there. And I think one question, Gary, is do you cater to that QB? Okay, we have a guy who doesn't throw downfield a whole lot. Carr threw down 20-plus yards downfield, about two-thirds as much as the average starter. And that's a big drop-off. That's a very little amount. Do we draft guys that try to encourage him to do that, or do we draft guys that play to how he already is? And that's a hard one to answer because Carr is kind of right on that line. Is he our franchise QB or not? The Raiders seem to be wondering that themselves at times.
Raiders also end up taking Damon Arnette, the Ohio State cornerback, with their second pick, a guy who I thought he was one of the guys who truly can, you play him on the boundary, you can play him in the slot. Personally, I like Jeff Gladney better, but I don't know. They like Damon Arnette. They got their guy.
They did. A lot of people thought they can get him later in the draft, and I understand that. And you know, I had to do the draft grade, so I factor that into the grade because that's kind of the game. I'm of the philosophy, look, the teams that can get a lot out of the picks and trade down and still get their guy, and every team's going to tell us they got their guy, but the teams that can really do it, they certainly have an advantage, and there's an art and a skill to it. I'm still the philosophy, it's hard to criticize a team for having a need, finding a player that they feel can fill that need, and taking the player. And whether some people thought, well, you could have gotten them 15 picks later, that stuff doesn't get remembered a whole lot a few years from now. In fact, nobody remembers that stuff a few years from now. So if the guy can play, it'll work out. If he can't, then maybe Mike Mayock takes some heat for it. I'm sure Mike Mayock sleeps just fine at night.
Yeah. No, we'll only remember if, like, Jeff Gladney becomes the new Deion Sanders or something like that, and then we'll go through, well, who got picked before him.
Perhaps. Although, let me ask you this. Who was – because Darrell Revis, I recall, was like the mid-first-round pick of the Jets. Do you remember that coming out of Pittsburgh?
I do.
Off the top of your head, if any, who were the corners taken ahead of Darrell Revis?
My guess would be nobody. But I'd say that with only probably 45% confidence.
Which I think right in and of itself proves our point right there. If you don't know right away – who else was ahead of Revis, then it proves, I'm looking it up right now in case you aren't. We probably have a few listeners that know and think, how can these guys not know? They have a show. How can they not know? But, you know, so Revis went number 14. He was the first corner off the board that year. Nice job, Gary.
There you go.
Do you remember who the second one was?
What was that, 2005?
Seven.
I know every pick of the 2005 draft, but not the 2007 draft.
I'll give you a hint on the second, then we'll move on.
Yeah.
The second corner has some connections to the same guy who's going to be coaching our friend from Ohio State here tonight.
Some connections Arnette. To Gruden.
The guy who's going to be more directly coaching Arnette.
Oh, connection to Gunther.
You're on it. Leon Hall. It's Leon Hall. That's the corner.
I would have gotten there eventually.
Yeah, eventually.
Okay.
But the point, you know, you get the point, though. I don't think people remember this stuff the way that they do now. They just don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Jerry Jeudy to the Broncos. I really thought the Broncos were going to have to come up to get Jerry Jeudy, and he ends up just sitting there at 15, and I believe you love this pick as well, Andy, and obviously – look, guys develop differently. No one's a lock, but Jeudy is not only – I thought he was a no-brainer for the best receiver in this draft. I realize Ruggs runs like Ruggs runs, and that is more appealing to somebody. But he is perfect as just a stylistic complement to Cortland Sutton in Denver. And obviously the Broncos had such a desperate need for wide receiver depth.
I agree with you. Sutton is a classic X receiver, the big-bodied guy. You put him on often the short side of the field, so whatever hash the ball is on. He lines up on that same side. He's by himself if it's a 3-by-1 formation. And he runs vertical routes and in-breaking routes primarily. That's what your typical X receiver does. Sutton does it really well. I mean, he has a chance to be, if he's not already, he might already be a top 10 receiver, in fact. So that's what they have, but they didn't have anybody else at all around him. So they needed what they call the Z receiver, the guy who goes in motion, runs all the intermediate routes, kind of the more versatile overall route runner. And that's Judy's profile to a T. So I love it when your receivers fit each other stylistically. And we're going to talk about another receiver that went with that joined a team that has a big time wideout already. When your pieces fit well together, I just think that's good drafting. And that's probably easy drafting. This is probably an easy call for Denver.
Yeah. I assume it, with that previous sentence, you're referring to CeeDee Lamb, who goes to Dallas here. And yeah, obviously Amari Cooper in there. I would imagine, and I know Lamb was an effective big slot at times at Oklahoma, but I would imagine Cooper now becomes, in their three receiver sets with Michael Gallup, Cooper becomes the slot guy and Lamb stays outside.
Yeah, and I'm sure Jerry Jones listened to our podcast a few weeks ago when we went over that and said that's exactly what Dallas needs to do. Because Amari Cooper, even though his contract says he's basically a flawless top-flight superstar, he's not flawless. He does struggle at times against press coverage. And by superstar receiver standards, he's been inconsistent, quite inconsistent at times. So it's the press coverage that factors into that. And it was the same case in Oakland. When you give Cooper a little bit of space, he's as good as any wide receiver in the NFL. So that's what you do if you're Dallas. Just smart football then. And we paid him all this money. Okay, we felt we had to pay him. Well, let's use him to the best of his ability. We have to give him a little bit of space. And when you put him in the slot, that's the only spot really that he's guaranteed to consistently get the space.
The Eagles stay at 21. They end up taking Jalen Reagor from TCU. And, I mean, look, I really enjoy watching him. He is quite boom or bust, though. I mean, he is probably after Ruggs, he's probably the second fastest receiver in this draft. And we've talked so much about how Philly just desperately needed speed in that offense. But, you know, Nelson Agholor's gone, and I know Eagles fans loved his drops over the years, and I think you're going to get a taste of that with Reagor now. So
The difference, though, is Reagor can run. Agholor really isn't a vertical runner, so
yeah.
You'll have 70-yard touchdowns as part of your memory bank with Reagor. The drops won't feel the same way as they did with Agholor.
Depending on the timing. I hope that's the case. He is – I mean, look – he's electric when you get the ball in his hands early. I mean, you know, you could say sort of a poor man's Tyreek Hill type of skill set here for him. And he was not terribly productive at TCU, but a lot of that was just very poor quarterback play. So now you get a great quarterback, a potential MVP candidate quarterback in Philly, and might unlock something here. But if nothing else, I mean, look, guy with this kind of speed, he affects what a defense does. No one's going to say, let's not cover him because he's just going to run downfield and probably drop it.
And remember, if DeSean Jackson's in there, then that's a problem for the defense. That's something they have to deal with, and that's going to impact Reagor very positively.
This next one, I really like Justin Jefferson as a prospect. I think he's going to be a very good – I think he'll be a very, very, very good number two receiver for the next, like, 6 to 8 years. This one was tough to figure out how it meshes, though, and you did write about this a little bit in the draft grades tonight because – you're going to play Adam Thielen as sort of that big slot guy. Jefferson was so productive out of the slot at LSU. I just wish he had landed somewhere that was really going to use him primarily as a slot guy, even though a lot of people would look at his physical profile and say, well, he can play outside. I know he can play outside, but he was completely dominant in the slot.
I don't disagree with the sentiment. I didn't watch him a whole lot at LSU, as you know, so I can't speak to exactly what he is, but we get the idea of what type of player he is as a concept. The rebuttal would be, as Minnesota, for one, we only have two receivers on the field a lot of the time, so that, you know, it's not, we only have a slot receiver, mm-hmm. which probably adds to your point, but we're such a play-action heavy offense that a lot of times our receivers line up inside, because when you run play action, that tends to be where your receivers line up, because that gives them a quicker route and path to blocking the safety. And a lot of teams feel that's important in their play action game, because they want to make the corner have to tackle instead of the safety. So go block the safety, leave the corner unblocked. The point is, he'll be lining up inside a lot in our system. He'll run in-breaking routes, because that also comes with play action. Think of how the Rams and the 49ers offenses look, or how the Vikings looked last year. So his style, he'll be an inside receiver for us still, even if he's not technically aligned in the slot. I think that would be their thinking in Minnesota.
And the Vikings also get Jeff Gladney, TCU cornerback, slightly undersized but long arm, very feisty guy, plays inside and out. I think that's a nice addition for them and fills a what is all of a sudden a very obvious need for the Vikings. And kind of the look, the 49ers, we were caught off guard by the Packers move up. The 49ers had a very odd draft. They traded down with the first pick, end up taking Javon Kinlaw. We'll talk about him in a second. But then they came and traded back up in round one and gave up some of those, you know, some of their few picks that they had in this draft to take Brandon Ayuk from Arizona State. And look, I absolutely love Brandon Ayuk. I can't remember if I said it on this show. I've been saying it just you know, around the house and that sort of thing. But I think Ayuk is a slightly more physically impressive version of, like, Deebo Samuel. Like, you're going to get the ball in his hands early.
That's a big statement, though. Deebo Samuel's a pretty impressive physical specimen at this point.
Ayuk is probably a little further behind in development than what Samuel was coming into last year, but Ayuk is a big-time catch-and-run guy, and on top of that, I think he has the ability to be a more complete receiver. I mean, he's, you know, he has one of those NBA builds where it's like, well, he's 5'11", but, you know, he also has the wingspan of a 9.5-foot human or something like that. I think he's going to become a downfield threat as well. I mean, I am very excited about him.
They must love him, because I was a little surprised they went with wide receiver in the first round, given that we've talked about the depth at wide receiver. And Peter King actually called me the other day, Gary, and we got to talking quite a bit. He called with this theory, and he's already run this in his Monday morning quarterback, so it's fine to share this. His theory was that second rounders have been a lot more productive than first rounders, and the numbers clearly bear that out. So he called, and we're talking the last four drafts, he called to ask me why I thought that was, and the second round picks have fit really well in the systems that they've been in. I think some of it's just good fortune, but these younger coaches, and Shanahan is a great illustration of that, in my opinion. They believe their system will win. If the guys run the designs the right way, I will out-scheme you, or I will out-leverage your defenders. I just need guys that know where they're going to be and be there on time. So I don't need to go drafting a first-round talent receiver and spend all that money, because I need a plug-and-play guy. Now, he's got to be a high-level plug-and-play guy. I'm going to ask him to do a lot of things, but I need a plug-and-play guy. And the other part is, a wide receiver is still dependent on a lot of things around him. Protection has to hold up so the quarterback can throw the ball. Throw has to be good enough. Coverage has to play out the right way. A receiver is dependent on a lot of factors, which would be another reason to not take one early in the draft compared to a defensive lineman, who the Niners took early on and took with their 13th pick. Defensive linemen's dependent on almost nothing. The ball's snapped, he's right there, and he's facing the blocker right in front of him, and if he beats him, he's probably getting to the ball. So there's not a lot of inhibitors. The Niners invest in first-round defensive linemen all the time. They're always taking second- and third-round receivers. I think that's because they feel that they need a lineman who can create, and receivers innately do not create, and we will create for them as long as they do what we tell them to do. So I was a little surprised that there was one they loved enough to trade all this up to get, and one wide receiver, that is, just because they've had success finding these guys in the second and third round. I think their system can make a second or third rounder as good as a first rounder.
And you mentioned the defensive lineman, Javon Kinlaw from South Carolina. They had traded down one spot, 13-14, and end up with Kinlaw there with their first round pick. And I mean, look, you know, obviously Javon Kinlaw is unlikely to be as good as DeForest Buckner. DeForest Buckner is a superstar player, but Kinlaw should be a very good player, and he makes a fraction of the money now. That's how this stuff works with a rookie wage scale. So I won't go on my rookie wage scale rant
no,
here,
go,
Andy.
No, go ahead and go on. Sure, that's what we all want to hear on draft night here. Go for it. Tell us how these guys whose dreams came true tonight, how they shouldn't be getting the kind of money they're getting. You want them to get more money, don't you?
They should be getting more money.
Yeah.
That's my point, Andy. But that was the obvious. This is not a Buckner for Kinlaw trade. The 49ers don't like Kinlaw better than Buckner. They just like Kinlaw at this price better than Buckner at his price, which is a large difference in price.
Absolutely, and I wouldn't be surprised if they liked Buckner at his price. They just couldn't afford it.
Yeah,
I mean you have a budget too.
Yep. Let's talk offensive tackles. That was another story in the first round here, and we kind of knew it would be. We'll start at the top here. Giants go with Andrew Thomas. Lots of reports they were trying to trade out of the pick. They end up not doing that. Probably the offers weren't very good. We didn't see either of those teams move up to try and get one of the quarterbacks there. So Giants go Andrew Thomas. I mean, look, in my opinion, I thought Andrew Thomas and Jedrick Wills were the top two of the top four, and then Becton and Wirfs were a little bit behind them. But a lot of teams seem to prefer Andrew Thomas as well.
That's interesting. I had not heard it that way. I was under the impression that it was Wirfs and Wills and then Becton and then Thomas kind of headlined the next tier of tackles. So, I had the wrong impression. I was a little surprised when Thomas was the announced pick, and I figure obviously he's the guy that the Giants want most because they had their choice of all of these guys. My guess is that's why they were trying to trade down, because they probably thought what I was thinking, which is that the teams that want tackles are going to look at Wirfs or Wills first.
Yeah, it's. I mean, look, that was the chatter that that we were hearing. We also were hearing chatter that the Dolphins had no interest in Tua, so take it for what it's worth. I will say the nice thing about Andrew Thomas, and look, however you wanted to order these offensive tackles, they were all pretty much in the same class. But the nice thing about Andrew Thomas is obviously he's going to start on the right side early on, and then I would imagine potentially move to the left side to replace Nate Solder at some point. But that is what he did at Georgia, and we talk about some of these guys and how it's sort of underrated or sort of overlooked as far as those were not good words. Those are like conflicting words. But it's sort of overlooked how difficult it can be for some guys to change from one side of the line to the other. Thomas has done it. He was a freshman All-American as a right tackle at Georgia, and then he moved to left tackle and starred there as well. So you know you're getting the flexibility to go either side of the line there.
And they need that because they need a right tackle right now, and they might need a left tackle next year because Nate Solder's contract becomes very expensive. And I think you could debate whether Solder has been worth that big number so far. So that's good flexibility. I'm sure that factored into New York's decision tonight.
Jedrick Wills goes to the Browns. We assume left tackle. He played right tackle at Alabama, but we assume left tackle for him, right tackle for Jack Conklin. But, I mean, look, that's what the Browns had to do this offseason, is fix the offensive line, especially the tackle spots. Really, only the tackle spots needed to be fixed. And it certainly seems they did that with Jedrick Wills and signing Jack Conklin.
You know, this Browns offense, Gary, has a chance to really be something. We thought it was going to be last year, and it didn't obviously come together for a number of reasons. But let's say Wills works out, and he's a solid rookie left tackle. They got Joel Bitonio left guard, obviously a plus player. J.C. Treader's an above-average center. He's a mobile guy. He'll fit Stefanski's zone scheme very well. I think Chris Hubbard, who's penciled in one of the tackle spots, he can probably, I don't know if he can play guard. He has the body type for it. So it's either Hubbard or Wyatt Teller at right guard and then Conklin at right tackle. That has a chance to be a top 10, top 12 offensive line. And the guys they're blocking for, it's Odell Beckham and Landry. And Hooper's an adequate tight end. And then Mayfield with two really, really good running backs and versatile running backs, Nick Chubb and Kareem Hunt. You put all of that together, Andy Janovich at fullback. Stefanski was great scheming with the fullback last year. This offense does not have a weakness. It doesn't mean it's the best offense in the NFL, but there is no apparent weakness. And I do think these guys really fit the way Stefanski is going to want to play.
Yeah. I mean, there's a really good chance the Browns were just a year late on the hype here if this offensive line works out. Mekhi Becton goes to the Jets, the massive left tackle from Louisville. I was kind of curious to see if the Jets would go with a receiver instead of one of the tackles early on, just because they just brought in a lot of guys. I'm not saying they brought in great guys, but they brought in a lot of guys. I wondered if they were going to look at it and just say, like, you know what? We'll figure it out with what we have.
Well, they have two very obvious needs. It was offensive line and wide receiver, and we're one pick into the draft, and I'm sure they're going to continue to address these needs very fully.
And then the Bucks jump up for Tristan Wirfs, one spot to get the last of the big four here, who he plugs right in at right tackle. Does this signal to you at all, Andy, that maybe this Bucks system with, it's sort of, Arians does downfield stuff and Brady does the quick strike stuff. That's the shorthand for the two of them at this stage in their careers. Does this signal to you that maybe we get a little more of an Arians flavor than a Brady flavor with this offense?
I think so. I've had that impression for a couple of weeks now. At first, I didn't know when Brady went there who adjusts for who. Brady's run the Arians. I don't know if he's run the Arians type scheme per se, but throwing the ball downfield, Brady's done that in every way you can imagine over his 20 years in the NFL. And I think he's going to be fine with that as long as he can be protected and feel comfortable enough. So I understood this pick completely. You know what I would have loved to hear is the phone call from the Niners, because I don't know how, how they got on the phone together, but they got on the phone at some point. Someone from the Niners probably said to Bruce Arians or GM Jason Licht, hey, we're thinking of moving McGlinchey over to left tackle here, which means we might need a right tackle. And Arians probably said, oh, come on, that bulger. No, yes, no, I'm serious. We are, coach. We might do it. And whatever it was, they sold him just enough that Arians felt he had to make the trade, move up that one spot.
It could all. I mean, look. You could also say, like, "Hey, we're shopping the pick. We got some teams interested. Like, what do you have?"
Yeah, that's
true.
Could
other teams come up for it.
You could do that as well. You could, but if the Niners trade down one spot, which they've done before with the Bears, of course, in the first round not long ago, and I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, my guess is they knew who the Bears were taking. And when teams trade down one spot, they ask the team they're trading with, well, who are you taking? As long as you're not taking our guy, it's fine. I would imagine the Niners knew the Bucks were taking a right tackle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would think so, too. We touched on Austin Jackson going to the Dolphins, and the last offensive tackle in this class. We'll skip over Cesar Ruiz. I know he's an offensive lineman. Let's talk about Cesar Ruiz real quick. It was a little bit curious the Saints took him because, I would think you're kind of set with Eric McCoy at center, which is Ruiz's main position. Now, I think Ruiz can be a very good guard in the league as well. I guess this is Larry Warford's replacement next year.
Yeah, Warford's their right guard. He's in a contract year. He's 29 now. He'll be 30 next year. He costs $12 million bucks right now. He's not a cheap player.
Mm-hmm.
To cut him would cost $5 million, roughly. So you'd still save $7, $8 million, a little bit here and there. Warford belongs on the field. He is a high-caliber starting right guard still, and I don't – obviously, that's the guy who's getting replaced. You're not taking a first rounder. Andres Pete just got a big contract at left guard, so he's there for a while. McCoy, I thought, played fine as a rookie. The Saints know more about him. Maybe they feel differently and they want to look at him at guard. Or Ruiz, they project to guard. I was surprised with this pick too, though, Gary, because I didn't know Warford. I'm surprised that Warford's a guy they want to replace all of a sudden. But, that's... it gets back to the money side of this too, kind of the DeForest Buckner conversation a little bit. But Warford's not going to cost what Buckner costs. I don't think Warford's going to cost a whole lot to re-sign next year even, but the Saints appear to not be making a run at him, would be my guess.
And the last offensive lineman off the board in the first round, Isaiah Wilson to the Titans. Pretty obvious plugging in for the old Jack Conklin spot here. And look, a little bit raw, but obviously big guy, impressive mover for his size. And a lot of teams seem to be kind of high on Isaiah Wilson.
So Mike Vrabel has gotten you and I talked a little bit before. He's been attention on Twitter for what the hell is going on in his house when he's getting the picks, and I think that was funny. And that's I like that. I like Vrabel as a person. That all fit. My question to you: do you think the NFL contacted these coaches beforehand and said, "Hey, we want your kids just standing randomly in the background on all these picks tonight"? Or do you think that was something? I think Matt Patricia was the first one who had a kid on the set with him, so to speak, because Zach Taylor's got a bunch of kids, and they've been out, and it's a public family. They've been out in front before. His kids were nowhere to be found. They were somewhere else in the house. Zach Taylor's by himself. Matt Patricia's kids kind of hanging out with them. Is that something where the other coaches saw that, Patricia, now we're going to look like we're not family, man, if we don't put our families in here? Everybody went and got their kids and said, stand here tonight. Or do you think there was a memo that went around saying, we want this to be a family atmosphere? Because a lot of these people were dressed up as well. The kids were wearing the team colors, but they probably were wearing that anyway if it's draft day in their dad's household.
Yeah, I think it's the former. I think it was a bunch of copycats.
League said to have kids around or anything?
No, I do not think the league said to. I think someone saw Patricia's kid. And look, a bunch of people probably were like, hey, you want to be on TV when I make the pick or whatever? I think it might have been spontaneous for some people, but I think some other folks probably saw like, oh, everyone's kind of hanging out. Like, we should make this a family thing.
Yeah, it was cool. It's fun to watch as it came out. And then Cliff Kingsbury had the most Cliff Kingsbury looking scene you could ever imagine on a white couch in a gigantic room, completely on his own Bachelor life. Just the contrast there. I enjoyed this evening. It was fun to see.
It was. It really was. All right, two miscellaneous things as we wrap up here. First thing, I said we were going to talk about Burrow a little bit, even though we've been talking about Burrow for a while. Let me just ask you, how good do you think the Bengals are in 2021? You're adding Burrow. You are getting back A.J. Green and Jonah Williams. Obviously, it's a very good division they're in, but I mean, are we looking at a pretty good jump here for the Bengals?
I think potentially. I think there is that chance for a quantum leap because the two issues they had last year on offense was where they could not block anybody and their wide receivers were pretty spotty. And those two things together give you no passing game. A.J. Green, we'll see what he has left, but even if he's just back in the lineup, and let's say John Ross stays healthy, and that's maybe a 50-50 proposition, unfortunately, but if you got A.J. Green and John Ross now together in the lineup, Tyler Boyd's in there as well. That's a receiving core. That's a quality receiving core that can get vertical, that can stretch the width of the field. And Jonah Williams at left tackle, I think, might have a stabilizing effect because when Cordy Glenn came back late last year for the Bengals, that offensive line did look different. And it wasn't just all Cordy Glenn. And obviously, it didn't go well with him last year. He's not here for a reason now. But the point is, there was at least a stability that trickled down from that to some degree. So if Jonah Williams gives him a quality left tackle, Michael Jordan at left guard is going to be better in year two. It's still not a great O-line, but you can play with it, perhaps. And last year, there were times where you really could not play with that offensive line.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, Joe Mixon was actually second in the NFL in rushing in the second half of the season. Only Derrick Henry had more.
So that doesn't surprise me. Mixon played well, and that line did get together. And I was thinking more from their pass protection standpoint, but you're right. Their run blocking got a lot better, and in their system, the run blocking and pass blocking are kind of one and the same because it's a play-action-based system.
And last thing I want to mention before we go, and I should mention also we will be back Monday morning to sort of sum up some of the other stuff that, you know, fell through the cracks in round one or popped up day two, day three. Look, Andy wrote the team needs article for all 32 teams for the MMQB, and he writes the team needs. I write the prospects who fit those team needs. And when you wrote up the Chiefs, I've been thinking this for a while. I was like, man, if they could get like Clyde Edwards-Helaire on day two, I love this guy. I really think he is like a slightly more dynamic James White. I think he is just, I'm not going to get into like running back value overall and everything, but he would be so much fun in Kansas City. I actually wrote just a little sentence at the end of your Chiefs team need saying, man, it doesn't fill a need, but it would be incredible if they could get Edwards-Helaire at the end of the second round. And instead they get him at the end of the first round. So again, they have some needs on defense. They have more picks to address those needs, but Edwards-Helaire in this offense is going to, they didn't need another sort of sort of layer to it, another playmaker here, but they got one.
Well, first of all, the way you queued that up, I was really bracing for a wonderful compliment coming my way, because the way you said Andy does the team needs for us, I thought, oh, Gary must have noticed I got like 25 of them right or something. I don't keep track, but Gary must have noticed something incredible I did. But that was just a bridge to you pointing out something incredible that Gary did, which was project Edwards-Helaire to the Chiefs. So
let me say, your team needs are workmanlike. How's that for a compliment?
That's I guess bland and satisfying to the minimal degree, but it's better than nothing.
Your team needs were completed.
I was really surprised. I'm not in the business of saying, no, this team shouldn't have taken that guy. They should take this guy instead, because obviously these guys know so much more about what's going on with them and the players they're looking at than I do. We talked about Xavier McKinney on the board, and there were other safeties on the board, other defensive backs. I was just really surprised they went for running back at this point in the draft, given who was still on the board defensively. Now, your point about Edwards-Helaire and does he fit, and you like him as a more dynamic James White, that's really well stated, and it kind of along our point from earlier, if this whole thing works out and Edwards-Helaire becomes a good player, nobody's going to say, why? Can you believe they didn't wait till the second round to get him? They're going to say, my gosh, look at all the weapons they have. So, you know, you're probably onto something here.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, there were all those rumors that they were going to come up and get Henry Ruggs, which would just be
that
unfair.
Almost seemed illegal. Yeah, I would have wanted the league to step in if that was going to be the case.
That'd be like when the Lakers weren't allowed to get Chris Paul.
Yeah, I
remember. Goodell would have to put a stop to that.
Yeah.
All right, Andy, this was fun. It is super early in the morning now where I am on Friday morning, so this will be out soon. We will be back Monday morning with a full draft recap. Please join us. But as for you, Andy, I hope you join us as well. Yeah, you're joining us. You're still a special guest, but you're joining us.
Somehow. All right, I'll talk to you Sunday night then.
Yes,
where we
you
record.
Will.
Yeah.
The MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast is me, Gary Gramling. Special thanks to our guest, Andy Benoit. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Mravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB. Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL Podcast. Keep up with our entire lineup of podcasts 5 days a week by subscribing to the MMQB NFL Podcast for free on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please do us a favor and leave a rating and review. It really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts. Podcasts.